the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising, and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Friday, February 27th, 2015. An in-depth look at the death of Malcolm X from his most famous speech, The Ballot or the Bullet, and the latest in immigration news with attacks on Obama's executive action, plus a prison riot in Texas, and what Greece's bailout deal really means. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Christina Mislan. She's an assistant professor of journalism studies at the Missouri School of Journalism. Hi, Christina.
Hello, Sonali.
Well, the Senate Judiciary Committee has just approved Loretta Lynch's nomination for attorney general, all but clearing the way for her to pass a full Senate vote. The vote was a narrow win for a candidate who came under fire for her decision some years ago not to prosecute one of the world's largest banks, HSBC, for money laundering while she was attorney general of New York. Meanwhile, outgoing attorney general Eric Holder announced that he would soon ask Congress to lower the bar on federal civil rights prosecutions. On Tuesday, the Justice Department said it did not have enough evidence to prosecute George Zimmerman for the death of Trayvon Martin. And in a few weeks, a similar announcement is likely coming on the shooting death by Darren Wilson of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Holder said on Thursday, quote, there needs to be a change with regard to the standard of proof. Well, Christina, does it seem as though the high hopes that many had for the position of attorney general under the Obama administration were being dashed? And do you think Loretta Lynch could be any more progressive than Eric Holder?
Well, I think first we need to be clear about what Lynch's nomination means. And I think, you know, the fact that we will have the first African-American woman to be attorney general, one, is symbolic in itself. So I don't want that to get lost in the conversation. Now, on the other hand, yes, we should also think about the politics here. And I don't want to compare or try to assume what Lynch would do as attorney general in comparison to Holder. I think, you know, with Holder, it took us a while to see him take some of the steps that he has taken in a couple of years. So I think, you know, maybe I'm being a little bit optimistic here, but maybe we should wait a little bit before we just completely lose all hope of having someone be at least just as progressive, maybe. But then again, I think Obama's presidential election gave us a lot of hope, and we've kind of lost some of that as well. So I think it, you know, it's going to take time to see how this all plays out.
Two right-wing political action committees, or PACs, are holding meetings. CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee, is starting its gathering today. And every major Republican presidential candidate, such as Jeb Bush and Scott Walker, are expected to make speeches and win over important constituents. The New York Times called CPAC, quote, a proving ground for Republican contenders in connecting with and inspiring the most enthusiastic, organized elements of the conservative base. And APAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, is also meeting in a few days. The Obama administration just announced that it would send advisor Susan Rice and UN Ambassador Samantha Power to the conference as representatives in a conciliatory move over recent tensions with Benjamin Netanyahu's visit. Well, Christina, do these two meetings represent the power of the right to organize? I mean, the left has no such gatherings, do they? Imagine a Palestinian rights event to which Obama sent representatives.
Yes, no, that would never happen. But I think, look, you know, often in this country, we have this conversation where people will say, well, the United States is becoming more conservative. And I just don't think that's true. I think it is what you're talking about here is that there is a right-wing power. And really, these are the people that are deciding the politics of this country. And these are, I mean, I saw a picture, I think it was in the New York Times, and it was a roll of nothing but white men. And so I thought, well, this is who's deciding what this country is looks like and what it does and its practices and its politics and its political agenda. So I think, if anything, we definitely should be concerned about the fact that it's these super powerful right-wing organizations that are deciding where this country is going and not representative of what the public actually looks like and believes.
And finally, the Federal Communications Commission in a 3-2 vote yesterday passed rules that are in line with net neutrality. After a year of intense lobbying by rights groups, FCC Chair Tom Wheeler last year came under fire for proposing a two-tiered system that would empower major cable companies, prompting a firestorm of criticism from those who want a level playing field. While the new rules are not yet public, they're expected to enshrine the internet as a public utility rather than an information service. Services for smartphones and tablets will also fall under the regulations alongside wired communications. The rules will also include broadband access to rural communities and people with disabilities. Abilities and protections of consumer privacy. Conservatives have lambasted the vote, with Fox News calling it, quote, the worst example of government intervention ever. Well, Christina, progressives are celebrating this decision. How important is it for causes dear to the left?
Yes, we are celebrating. Yesterday, I thought to myself, about time. I think, you know, for the past, since Reagan's administration, we've seen the FCC continuously deregulate, or as some people would say, regulate, but for some people's interests, right? For basically big conglomerates' interests. And so in the past few decades, we've seen this trend. And finally, I think there is something to say, well, maybe, you know, the FCC is finally doing something good. I mean, we're talking about the elimination of things like the Fairness Doctrine and the huge, the Act of 1996 that basically has allowed us to have the big five media conglomerates that we have today. And so the FCC this week has taken a really important step, hopefully, at least in the case of the internet. Look, you know, this country, we go and we tell everyone else, well, the internet is important for upholding democracy, but we can't really continue that line of logic if in this country itself, it's not being upheld as this tool for democracy. And so it's really important. Right.
Thank you so much, Christina Mislan. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you.
Our Daily Newsflash guest expert, Christina Mislan, is an assistant professor of journalism studies at the Missouri School of Journalism. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of one of the most important figures in the Black militant struggle for freedom, Malcolm X. Fatally shot on February 21st, 1965, Malcolm X's legacy includes a bold and unwavering view of Black human rights. He was a man who was constantly evolving, having spent the early years of his life as a criminal before undergoing a personal transformation in prison. He joined the Nation of Islam when he changed his name to Al-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz. And years later, Malcolm X broke from the Nation of Islam and went on to found the Organization of Afro-American Unity and explored Pan-Africanism. On February 21, 1965, just a short while after breaking from the Nation of Islam, three of the organization's members assassinated Malcolm X. 10 months before he was killed, Malcolm X gave his most famous speech, The Ballot or the Bullet, where he advised African Americans to exercise their right to vote, but also warned that members of Congress were all alike in their desire to disenfranchise blacks. Most importantly, he warned that blacks might have to take up arms if their constitutional rights were not respected. Today, courtesy of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and on the final weekday of Black History Month, just over 50 years after Malcolm X was killed, we present a lengthy excerpt from his speech, The Ballot or the Bullet.
This afternoon, we want to talk about the ballot or the bullet. The ballot or the bullet explains itself. But before we get into it, since this is the year of the ballot or the bullet, I would like to clarify some things that refer to me personally concerning my own personal position. I'm still a Muslim. That is, my religion is still Islam. My religion is still Islam. I still credit Mr. Muhammad for what I know and what I am. He's the one who opened my eyes. At present, I'm the minister of the newly founded Muslim Mosque Incorporated, which has its offices in the Teresa Hotel right in the heart of Harlem. That's the Black Belt in New York City. And when we realize that Adam Clayton Powell is a Christian minister, he has the Abyssinia Baptist Church, but at the same time, he's more famous for his political struggling. And Dr. King is a Christian minister in Atlanta, Georgia, but he's become more famous for being involved in a civil rights struggle. The same as they are Christian ministers, I'm a Muslim minister. And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter. Islam is my religion, but I believe my religion is my personal business. It governs my personal life, my personal morals, and my religious philosophy is personal between me and the God in whom I believe, just as the religious philosophy of these others is between them and the God in whom they believe. And this is best this way. Were we to come out here discussing religion, we'd have too many differences from the outstart, and we could never get together. So today, though Islam is my religious philosophy, my political, economic, and social philosophy is black nationalism. As I say, if we bring up religion, we'll have differences, we'll have arguments, we'll never be able to get together. But if we keep our religion at home, keep our religion in the closet, keep our religion between ourselves and our God, but when we come out here, we have a fight that's common to all of us against an enemy who is common to all of us. The political philosophy of black nationalism only means that the black man should control the politics and the politicians in his own community. The time when white people can come in our community and get us to vote for them so that they can be our political leaders and tell us what to do and what not to do is long gone. By the same token, the time when that same white man, knowing that your eyes are too far open, can send another Negro into the community, get you and me to support him so he can use him to lead us astray, those days are long gone. The political philosophy of black nationalism only means that if you and I are going to live in a black community, and that's where we're going to live, because as soon as you move into one of their, soon as you move out of the black community into their community, it's mixed for a period of time, but they're gone, and you're right there all by yourself. We must understand the politics of our community, and we must know what politics is supposed to produce. We must know what part politics play in our lives. And until we become politically mature, we will always be misled, led astray, or deceived, or maneuvered into supporting someone politically who doesn't have the good of our community at heart. So the political philosophy of black nationalism only means that we will have to carry on a program, a political program of re-education to open our people's eyes, make us become more politically conscious, politically mature. And then we will, whenever we get ready to cast our ballot, that ballot will be cast for a man of the community who has the good of the community at heart. And the economic philosophy of black nationalism only means that we should own and operate and control the economy of our community. You would never find, you can't open up a black store in a white community. White man won't even patronize you. And he's not wrong. He got sense enough to look out for himself. And you who don't have sense enough to look out for yourself. The white man is too intelligent to let someone else come and gain control of the economy of his community. But you will let anybody come in and control the economy of your community, control the housing, control the education, control the jobs, control the businesses, under the pretext that you want to integrate. No, you're out of your mind. The economic philosophy of black nationalism only means that we have to become involved in a program of re-education to educate our people into the importance of knowing that when you spend your dollar out of the community in which you live, the community in which you spend your money becomes richer and richer. The community out of which you take your money becomes poorer and poorer. And because these Negroes who have been misled, misguided, are breaking their necks to take their money and spend it with the man, the man is becoming richer and richer, and you're becoming poorer and poorer. And then what happens? The community in which you live becomes a slum. It becomes a ghetto. The conditions become run down. And then you have the audacity to complain about poor housing in a run-down community. Why, you run it down yourself when you take your dollar out. And you and I are in a double trap, because not only do we lose by taking our money someplace else and spending it, when we try and spend it in our own community, we're trapped because we haven't had sense enough to set up stores and control the businesses of our community. The man who's controlling the stores in our community is a man who doesn't look like we do. He's a man who doesn't even live in the community. So you and I, even when we try and spend our money in the block where we live or the area where we live, we're spending it with a man who, when the sun goes down, takes that basket full of money in another part of the town. So we're trapped, double trapped, triple trapped. Anywhere we go, we find that we're trapped. And every kind of solution that someone comes up with is just another trap. But the political and economic philosophy of black nationalism, the economic philosophy of black nationalism shows our people the importance of setting up these little stores and developing them and expanding them into larger operations. Woolworth didn't start out big like they are today. They started out with a dime store and expanded and expanded and then expanded until today they're all over the country and all over the world, and they're getting some of everybody's money. Now, this is what you and I and General Motors, the same way, didn't start out like it is. It started out just a little rat race type operation, and it expanded and expanded until today it's where it is right now. And you and I have to make a start. And the best place to start is right in the community where we live. So So our people not only have to be re-educated to the importance of supporting black business, but the black man himself has to be made aware of the importance of going into business. And once you and I go into business, we own and operate at least the businesses in our community, what we will be doing is developing a situation wherein we will actually be able to create employment for the people in the community. And once you can create some employment in the community where you live, it will eliminate the necessity of you and me having to act ignorantly and disgracefully, boycotting and picketing some cracker someplace else, trying to beg him for a job. Anytime you have to rely upon your enemy for a job, you're in bad shape. When you, and he is your enemy, anytime, you wouldn't be in this country if some enemy hadn't kidnapped you and brought you here. On the other hand, some of you think you came here on the Mayflower. So as you can see, brothers and sisters, today, this afternoon, it's not our intention to discuss religion. We're going to forget religion. If we bring up religion, we'll be in an argument. And the best way to keep away from arguments and differences, as I said earlier, put your religion at home, in the closet. Keep it between you and your God. Because if it hasn't done anything more for you than it has, you need to forget it anyway. Whether you are a Christian or a Muslim or a nationalist, we all have the same problem. They don't hang you because you're a Baptist, they hang you because you're black. They don't attack me because I'm a Muslim, they attack me because I'm black. They attack all of us for the same reason. All of us catch hell from the same enemy. We're all in the same bag, in the same boat. We suffer political oppression, economic exploitation, and social degradation. All of them from the same enemy. The government has failed us. You can't deny that. Anytime you live in the 20th century and you walking around here singing, "We shall overcome," the government has failed us. This is part of what's wrong with you. You do too much singing. Today it's time to stop singing and start swinging. You can't sing up on freedom, but you can swing up on some freedom. Cassius Clay can sing, but singing didn't help him to become the heavyweight champion of the world. So this government has failed us. The government itself has failed us. And the white liberals who have been posing as our friends have failed us. And once we see that all these other sources to which we've turned have failed, we stop turning to them and turn to ourselves. We need a self-help program, a do-it-yourself philosophy, a do-it-right-now philosophy, it's already too late philosophy. This is what you and I need to get with. And the only way we're going to solve our problem is with a self-help program. Before we can get a self-help program started, we have to have a self-help philosophy. Black nationalism is a self-help philosophy. What's so good about it? You can stay right in the church where you are and still take black nationalism as your philosophy. You can stay in any kind of civic organization that you belong to and still take black nationalism as your philosophy. You can be an atheist and still take black nationalism as your philosophy. This is a philosophy that eliminates the necessity for division and argument. Because if you're black, you should be thinking black. And if you're black and you're not thinking black at this late date, well, I'm sorry for you. Once you change your philosophy, you change your thought pattern. Once you change your thought pattern, you change your attitude. Once you change your attitude, it changes your behavior pattern. And then you go on into some action. As long as you got a sit-down philosophy, you'll have a sit-down thought pattern. And as long as you think that old sit-down thought, you'll be in some kind of sit-down everywhere. It's not so good to refer to what you're going to do as a sit-in. That right there castrates you. Right there it brings you down. What goes with it? What think of the image of someone sitting? An old woman can sit. An old man can sit. A chump can sit. A coward can sit. Anything can sit. Well, you and I have been sitting long enough, and it's time today for us to start doing some standing and some fighting to back that up. When we look at other parts of this earth upon which we live, we find that black, brown, red, and yellow people in Africa and Asia are getting their independence. They're not getting it by singing, "We Shall Overcome." No, they're getting it through nationalism. It is nationalism that brought about the independence of the people in Asia. Every nation in Asia gained its independence through the philosophy of nationalism. Every nation on the African continent that has gotten its independence brought it about through the philosophy of nationalism. And it will take black nationalism that to bring about the freedom of 22 million Afro-Americans here in this country where we have suffered colonialism for the past 400 years. America is just as much a colonial power as England ever was. America is just as much a colonial power as France ever was. In fact, America is more so a colonial power than they, because she's a hypocritical colonial power behind it. What is 20th, what do you call second-class citizenship? Why, that's colonization. Second-class citizenship is nothing but 20th century slavery. How are you going to tell me you're a second-class citizen? They don't have second-class citizenship in any other government on this earth. They just have slaves and people who are free. Well, this country is a hypocrite. They try and make you think they set you free by calling you a second-class citizen. No, you're nothing but a 20th century slave. Just as it took nationalism to remove colonialism from Asia and Africa, it'll take black nationalism today to remove colonialism from the backs and the minds of 22 million Afro-Americans here in this country. Looks like it might be the year of the ballot or the bullet. Why does it look like it might be the year of the ballot or the bullet? Because Negroes have listened to the trickery and the lies and the false promises of the white man now for too long. And they're fed up. They've become disenchanted. They've become disillusioned. They've become dissatisfied. And all of this has built up frustrations in the black community that makes the black community throughout America today more explosive than all of the atomic bombs the Russians can ever invent. Whenever you got a racial powder keg sitting in your lap, you're in more trouble than if you had an atomic powder keg sitting in your lap.
And you have been listening to a lengthy excerpt of the most famous speech made by Malcolm X, The Ballot or the Bullet, given April 12th, 1964 in Detroit. Special thanks to the Pacifica Radio Archives. This is Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can now subscribe for direct access to all our shows online at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Your subscription sustains the TV production of Uprising. A federal judge named Andrew Hanen in Brownsville, Texas, has single-handedly quashed the hopes, at least temporarily, of millions of undocumented immigrants who were hoping for deportation relief as a result of President Obama's executive action. The program, called Deferred Action for Parents of Americans and Lawful Permanent Residents, or DAPA, was just hours away from accepting its first applications when Hanen put a hold on the program so that a group of 25 states could sue the White House over the policy. The move is happening in tandem with Republican efforts to use the legislative process to undermine DAPA through holding hostage the annual funding for the Department of Homeland Security. Also in Texas in recent days, there was a major riot at a detention center in Raymondville by nearly 3,000 undocumented prisoners. The inmates were being held in a privately run prison that has come under fire from civil rights groups in the past, using pipes to tear down structures they protested, among other things, a lack of medical care. My guests are Salvador Sarmiento, Director of Legislative Affairs at the National Day Labor Organizing Network, and Carl Takei, a staff attorney with the ACLU's National Prison Project, co-author of Warehoused and Forgotten, Immigrants Trapped in Our Shadow Prison System. Welcome to Uprising, Salvador and Carl.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, Salvador, let's start with you. First of all, the efforts to block DAPA legislatively are pretty much a blow to about 4 to 5 million undocumented immigrants, parents of citizens or permanent residents. How is this judge justifying halting this program?
Sure. We think that the decision by the Texas judge, the initial ruling by the Texas judge, is an example of judicial vigilantism. And there's actually a lot more politics behind his ruling than there is law. The decision is actually quite narrow, and it really seems as he was grasping at law on which to try to base his decision. So the actual decision, there's a lot of rhetoric, a lot of anti-immigrant rhetoric in it. It's a long decision, over 100 pages. But the actual decision is quite narrow. First, he rules initially that the way that the program was rolled out was didn't comply with the Administrative Procedures Act. So he doesn't actually rule that the new program, DAPA, or the extension of DACA, are unconstitutional. He really specifically just says that the way that it was rolled out was not in compliance with administrative procedures that would have been required. And then the second thing that makes it quite narrow is that it really just focuses on the specific DAPA and extension of DACA. It doesn't include many other adjustments that took place on November 20th of last year, and it doesn't really affect a whole menu of authorities and options that the president still has to provide relief to immigrants in the U.S.
And Salvador, is the lawsuit that the judge is using as a reason for stopping temporarily DAPA, how serious is it? And some are saying that it's being authored by Kris Kobach, the Secretary of State at Kansas, a very, very conservative anti-immigrant advocate. But 25 states, that's half the country.
It's definitely sad, worrisome that so many of our institutions have been are being used in this way, and it's very much a political use of what you know of our judiciary, for example. And it's sad, and it should be upsetting to the not just the legal community, but to you know the American people that our courts are being used, and currently our Congress as well is being used in such a political way. Of course, Kobach out in Kansas has been one of the, you know, we hesitate to say intellectual leaders of what has been a national nativist movement. He was the author of 1070, the anti-immigrant Show Me Your Papers law in Arizona. And this definitely falls under that same effort. And it's important to say that, you know, there's going to be segments in it, both in the Republican Party and outside of the Republican Party, that will use the issue of immigration and continue to use the issue of immigration until we can secure protections for the population of 11 million undocumented immigrants in the U.S.
I want to turn to Carl Takei. The judge is in Brownsville, but in another part of Texas, in Raymondville, the incredible riot took place just a week ago today in this correctional facility, as it's called. First, and you've written about this, you've documented some of the abuses there. So to explain for our listeners how immigrants are even ending up, 2,800 undocumented men even ending up in this facility, and what sort of conditions did they face?
Yeah, Willacy is one of 13 private prisons in the federal system. It's sort of a shadow system inside the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And it holds about 25,000 immigrants around the country who are serving federal prison sentences, either for drug offenses or for something called illegally reentering the United States after deportation. This is something that used to be handled entirely by the civil immigration system. But starting about 10 years ago, Operation Streamline and other prosecution programs started prioritizing these prosecutions. And now people are serving federal prison sentences for just crossing the border. And the scale of these cases is staggering. In Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, all of those courts along the southwest border, more than 80% of the federal criminal cases filed in 2013 were for crossing the border. That's out of all of the federal criminal cases filed in these districts. And they're the majority of federal criminal cases nationwide. So it's created this huge flow of people into the federal prison system just for immigration offenses. And the people who are housed in these prisons reserved for non-citizens are consigned to the private prison system by the Bureau of Prisons because the Bureau doesn't believe that it needs to provide the same services and programs to people that it assumes will be deported at the end of their sentences. Hmm.
And so what sort of conditions have you documented that these men are facing? I understand that Friday's riot was about lack of access to medical care, but I'm guessing that it was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah, I visited Willacy in 2013, and the overwhelming impression that I got from the people that I interviewed there was despair. They described living in these 200-foot-long Kevlar tents because Willacy, it's not a brick-and-mortar prison. Most of the people who are incarcerated at Willacy are living in literally tents, and they're packed in overcrowded bunks. People said that if you lay down in your bunk, you can touch your feet to the bunk of the person next to you. They described how there were infestations of insects that would come and bite them in their bunks at night. They also described how the toilets were constantly overflowing and how the smell of sewage would permeate the tents. Solitary confinement was another big issue. The prison used these isolation cells as overflow. So if you were transferred into Willacy, oftentimes you would end up stuck in an isolation cell, not because you'd done anything wrong, but just because there weren't enough spaces available inside the tents. On medical care too, as you said, it's the straw that broke the camel's back. Hmm. There was a pervasive sense that corners were cut and that people were denied basic medical requests.
Salvador, when we see discussions at the congressional level about immigrants and the treatment they receive, these sorts of issues rarely come up. This is a for-profit prison system that is counting on the warehousing, as the ACLU put it, of thousands of immigrants around the country. And yet in Congress, the discussions focus on, on how best to make this country a very difficult place for immigrants to live. Can you tell us about how the congressional representatives from the GOP are putting up roadblocks to the funding of the Department of Homeland Security over President Obama's executive action? So in addition to the lawsuit that's coming down the pipe that on the basis of which the Texas judge has stopped executive action, DAPA, from going forward, they're holding the funding of DHS hostage in Congress, filibustering, et cetera. And no one, you know, in these discussions, it never comes up how we treat immigrants.
Precisely. We'll know by the end of today whether the Republicans are going to basically block funding for DHS. Apparently, a bill's already been passed through the Senate to fund DHS through September, and it's currently being kind of trucking along in the House. But, you know, it's important not to get lost in the weeds about the circus that's happening on the Hill right now. You know, what ultimately when people are suffering on a day-to-day basis, when, you know, we're literally there are uprisings in the immigrant detention system, what's happening in Congress is really a circus, and we can't let it be a distraction from our efforts to really advance the efforts to secure rights for the entire population of immigrants. I think what's also important to say about the Texas uprisings has it reminds us of the efforts over the last year of immigrants that are in detention to really stand up for their rights and for their humanity. We remember last year there was a pretty widespread hunger strike that took place in Texas and in Washington State and in a couple other states. And it's important to say that despite the actions taken in November, you know, that population that was on hunger strike last year, in large part, is still in detention. You know, the massive immigrant detention and deportation machine that has been built up over the last decade has not disappeared. And it's important to say then that the decisions, the actions that Obama took on November 20th of last year cannot be the end of the story. They cannot be the ceiling. They have to be an initial step toward dismantling what is a massive deportation and detention system. And we hope that Obama continues to take steps in that direction.
Now, Carl, what has come of the situation in Willacy County Correctional Facility after this riot a week ago? I understand that up to 1,000 people have been transferred out. Essentially, the place was destroyed. It was uninhabitable, which you can just imagine the anger being felt by the inmates housed there. And the media, you know, of course, especially the right-wing media, covered this as more proof that immigrants are dangerous people. What is the aftermath so far?
Well, the Bureau of Prisons has indicated that they're going to transfer the entire population, so that's about 2,800 people, out of Willacy and into other prisons across the country. But that doesn't deal with the larger question of what the Bureau of Prisons is going to do about these private prisons, where abuse and mistreatment has allowed to run rampant, where the Bureau of Prisons has turned a blind eye. This uprising is just the inevitable consequence of that system that the BOP and these private prison companies have created together. And what's really necessary is for the Bureau of Prisons to pull out of this entirely and stop the use of private prisons.
And so on this issue of the money that is often, you know, made off of immigrants, Salvador, what do you foresee, or how do you foresee the conversations in Congress playing out? And do you foresee these, and I want to ask Carl this as well, how the imprisonment of immigrant inmates is being tackled at the legislative level, if at all? So Salvador, first, how do you foresee the lawsuit and the DHS funding to play out in the next week or so? What should we look for?
We think it's important to emphasize that it's not just the Republicans that are permitting the massive incarceration of immigrants. When Democrats are calling for a clean DHS bill, you know, that clean DHS bill includes enormous amounts of funding to identify, for surveillance, for identification, detention of undocumented folks, of immigrant folks. And even in the president's own budget, you know, there's still basically the infrastructure of the massive secure communities deportation dragnet. It's still in there. Right. So, you know, we can't put our eggs in the, you know, in the Republican Party's basket and expect, you know, them to, you know, we can hope they'll take back their party from the extremist wing that's in control right now. But it's also important that we demand, you know, that the Democrats and including President Obama actually use the authority that he has, because he still has a menu of options to provide relief, which he still has not used.
And finally, Carl Takei, what do you hope for legislatively to come out of this prison riot? Something has to change. And are members of Congress willing to change this? Or is this something that can happen at a lower level, at the DHS level, for example?
Well, it's something that the Bureau of Prisons needs to address, but it's also, you know, we need to change the approach that we use for immigration issues. People should not be being mass criminally prosecuted just for trying to reunite with their families in the United States or get jobs in the United States. And nor should they be detained for trying to enter the United States and apply for asylum because of terrible conditions in their home countries. One of the things that about this clean DHS bill, for example, that Senator Blumenthal and Senator Leahy pointed out recently is that it includes funding for a 2,400-bed immigration detention center in Texas that is reserved entirely for mothers and children fleeing violence in Central America.
Wow.
And that's the biggest immigration detention facility in the country.
Well, I want to thank the two of you very much for joining us today, and best of luck in the work that you do.
Thank you.
My guests are Salvador Sarmiento, Director of Legislative Affairs of the National Day Labor Organizing Network, and Carl Takei, Staff Attorney with the ACLU's National Prison Project. This is Uprising. When we come back, we'll get an update on Greece. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. A week ago today, Greece's newly elected Syriza party entered into an agreement giving it a four-month extension on a bailout deal in a move that is widely being cast as the party's first major defeat. Coming to power with much pomp and celebration, the government of Alexis Tsipras offered promises to end austerity in a country that has seen the worst downturn in Western Europe since the 1930s. But Europe's financial elite would have none of it, and the Eurozone finance minister stood their ground last week in refusing to budge on most of Syriza's demands. As of now, the only power that the Greek government has over its economy is the power to choose which cuts to make and where in order to satisfy structural adjustment requirements of its debt obligations. Syriza has taken a major beating in both the major media and many parts of the left blogosphere. The question is, what choice did they have? My guest is Nantina Vagontsas. She is a Greek-American PhD student in sociology at New York University, focusing on political economy and social movements. She's active in the labor movement and currently a member of the UAW Graduate Student Organizing Committee. And she's lived and worked in Athens for a year following the elections. Welcome to Uprising, Nantina.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
Thanks for joining us and welcome back. I should say we had you on right after the election. So how do you explain what happened last week? What leverage did Tsipras and his finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, have last week going into these negotiations? And how did they lose that leverage?
Yeah, so we should start, you know, with Monday, when ostensibly they were about to arrive at an agreement with a document that Pierre Moscovici, the European Commissioner for Economic Affairs, had presented to Varoufakis and the rest of the Greek negotiating team, that seemed pretty amenable to what the Greek government was expecting. But in the last minute of that day, Jerome Dijsselbloem, who was the president of the Eurogroup, which is the body of Eurozone finance ministers, changed that document, and the Greek government rejected that. So then, you know, moving into the week, they reached basically a kind of intransigence on the creditors' part, which amounted to increasing pressures, you know, both in terms of financial speculation, you know, the stock markets are starting to vacillate, but also in terms of withdrawal from banks. You know, this was a really big issue that Syriza had to deal with even upon entering power. 20 billion euros have been withdrawn from Greek banks since December, and on Friday alone, 1 billion euros were withdrawn. So, you know, the Greek government was really facing an issue of a possible bank run, of banks going essentially bankrupt, and they had to make a move as to whether, you know, to agree to the deal, which you accurately laid out as being a retreat on many of its electoral promises, or of taking more drastic measures that would have given it, you know, more time to, you know, stick to its own guns. And those measures would have included imposing capital controls, even nationalizing the banks, and then, you know, even more drastically considering default and exiting from the currency union. And it really seems that that was not in their plan. You know, Varoufakis had said to the media and, of course, to the negotiators going into this that, you know, we're going to be able to convince you that this is something that's not just good for Greece, but for Europe, because we want to raise growth levels throughout the currency union.
Now, Nantina, do you think that Yanis Varoufakis and Alexis Tsipras showed their hand too early in saying right from the outset that the Greek exit from the Eurozone is off the table? Did that reduce and remove their leverage?
Well, you know, they're playing a kind of tricky game here, because on the one hand, you know, they're saying that they're very committed to the Eurozone. But when people would tell Varoufakis, well, what if they just don't accept your demands? He would say, well, try us, right? And implicitly, he was saying that there was some kind of Grexit threat, as they call it.
Grexit, yeah.
But, you know, it turned out that they weren't preparing for that kind of plan B. A plan B actually requires a plan. And, you know, just months before the election, they had dropped from their platform the initiative to nationalize banks. And some of us thought that perhaps this was just pre-electoral posturing. You know, they didn't want to worry investors prior to it, but if push came to shove, they would have actually gone through with that. And it seems that this wasn't an option that they were willing to do. And, you know, Stathis Kouvelakis, who's one of the members of the Central Committee on Syriza, one of the leading members of its left platform, had said that, you know, this was the good Euro strategy that the leadership of Syriza has been pursuing since 2012. Prior to 2012, which is when Syriza became the opposition government, they had said that, you know, not one sacrifice for the Eurozone. And it seems that they transitioned to saying, well, we're going to stay in the Eurozone and it might be at some cost.
Now, Nantina, if, as you said, billions of dollars have left the Greek economy because depositors, essentially banks, took out their deposits, then wouldn't a Greek exit from the Eurozone leave Greece with no money to pay for anything?
Well, no, because if you exit from the Eurozone, you're also going to do that with a default, which gives you a great amount of fiscal autonomy that the Greek government, of course, hasn't had since it entered the currency union, right? So this is where debt and austerity become linked. And I think one of the weaknesses of the good Euro strategy is they try to delink the two, saying that we can confront the humanitarian crisis that has been caused by austerity by rolling back austerity, but we're going to try to renegotiate the debt as opposed to unilaterally rejecting it. If you unilaterally reject the debt, that means that then, you know, you have more space for budgetary capacities and you're not going to strive for balanced budgets for primary surpluses that the institutions formerly known as the Troika were expecting. You know, the Greek government at this point signed on to a deal that's going to make them commit to 4.5% primary surpluses, which economists throughout the world have said that that's just unachievable. It's not just that it's harsh, it's actually practically infeasible. So this option would have given them that leverage. And then, of course, you would have to have accompanying measures. And like I said, those would include capital controls, nationalizing the banks, so that the, you know, Greek government actually has some control over those decisions. And then, of course, you would also have to have immediate measures of rationing food, fuel, pharmaceutical supplies, and then you would move into more, you know, intermediary measures of doing some kind of industrial policy. And at the same time, you would also use the leverage that you have from other people and other countries that are trying to counterpose against the Eurozone, for instance, Russia, China, even the pink-type countries in Latin America. And you've seen that Tsipras, you know, has been talking with these actors, because we've realized that they can't just be discussing, you know, with the good Euro partners.
And Antina, is there discord within the party itself? I mean, this is a party that's not very old and has had power for just weeks, but is there discord within the party about the position that Tsipras and Varoufakis took?
Yes, there has been. And it hasn't just been from its left wing. You even have prominent actors from the dominant faction of Syriza. For instance, John Mignon, who's the director of their political economy team, he's very much identified with the leadership in Syriza. He even came out against the deal. And he said that there needs to be a revisit of the strategic debates in Syriza. And then, of course, these have been supplemented by the voices of dissent within the left platform. As I mentioned, there was Stasis Kouvelakis. There's also Kostas Papavitsas, who is an elected MP and a noted economist, who for years has been discussing that Greece needs to really be talking about a plan B. You also have Panagiotis Lafazanis, who's the energy minister, whose, you know, comments have had to be a bit more measured because of the position that he occupies. Even more importantly, instead of just focusing on individual actors, I should note that the parliamentary team of Syriza met on Wednesday to discuss the deal.
Right.
And instead of having a three-hour discussion, which is what they had originally planned, It ended up being extended into 11 hours, at the end of which Tsipras called a vote to see how people felt about the deal. And a third of the MPs in attendance rejected the deal, which has led to the point of Tsipras reconsidering whether he's going to take the deal to a parliamentary vote, which was scheduled for this weekend.
We're going to have to continue our conversation later. Nantina, I want to thank you so much for helping us understand, at least briefly, what's happening in Greece. Thanks so much. Nantina Vegontsas is a Greek-American PhD student in sociology at New York University, focusing on political economy and social movements. This is Uprising. Bipasha Shom is our senior producer. Anna Buss is our assistant producer. Michael Casey and Darren Quint are our research interns. Dan Swerdlove is our technical director. Christian Beck is our production assistant. Federico Garcia and Jonathan Alexander are our audio engineers. Annie Mendoza is our social media coordinator. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. Have a wonderful weekend. I'll see you Monday.